Hyacinthe learned some French and was taught a few of the teachings of the Catholic Church. Each day he cut sugar cane from well before the sun rose until after the sun had set. He fathered several children. He went with the other slaves in the small hours of the night to the woods, although it was forbidden, to dance the Kalinda, to sing to Dambalawedo, the serpent god, in the form of a black snake. He sang to Alegba, to Ogu, Shango, Zaka, and to many others, all the gods the captives had brought with them to the island, brought in their minds and their secret hearts. The slaves on the sugar plantations of Saint-Domingue rarely lived more than a decade. The free time they were given, 2 hours in the heat of noon, and 5 hours in the dark of the night, from 11 until 4, was also the only time they had to grow and tend to the food they would eat, for they were not fed by their masters, merely given small plots of land to cultivate, with which to feed themselves, and it was also the time they had to sleep and to dream. Even so, they would take that time, and they would gather and dance and sing and worship. The soil of Saint-Domingue was a fertile soil, and the gods of Dahomey and the Congo and the Niger put down thick roots there and grew lush and huge and deep, and they promised freedom to those who worshipped them at night in the groves. Hyacinthe was 25 years of age when a spider bit the back of his right hand. The bite became infected, and the flesh on the back of his hand was necrotic. Soon enough, his whole arm was swollen and purple, and the hand stank. It throbbed, and it burned. They gave him crude rum to drink, and they heated the blade of a machete in the fire until it glowed red and white. They cut his arm off at the shoulder with a saw, and they cauterized it with the burning blade. He lay in a fever for a week. Then he returned to work. The one-armed slave, called Hyacinthe, took part in the slave revolt of 1791. Elegba himself took possession of Hyacinthe in the grove, riding him as a white man rode a horse, and spoke through him. He remembered little of what was said, but the others who were with him told him that he had promised them freedom from their captivity. He remembered only his erection, rod-like and painful, and raising both hands, the one he had and the one he no longer possessed, to the moon. A pig was killed, and the men and the women of that plantation drank the hot blood of the pig, pledging themselves and binding themselves into a brotherhood. They swore that they were an army of freedom, pledged themselves once more to the gods of all the lands from which they had been dragged as plunder. "If we die in battle with the whites," they told each other, "we will be reborn in Africa, in our homes, in our own tribes." There was another Hyacinthe in the uprising, so they now called Agassou by the name of Big One Arm. He fought, he worshipped, he sacrificed, he planned. He saw his friends and his lovers killed, and he kept fighting. They fought for 12 years, a maddening, bloody struggle with the plantation owners, with the troops brought over from France. They fought and they kept fighting, and impossibly, they won. On January the 1st, 1804, the independence of Saint-Domingue, soon to be known to the world as the Republic of Haiti, was declared. Big One Arm did not live to see it. He had died in August 1802, bayoneted by a French soldier. At the precise moment of the death of Big One Arm, who had once been called Hyacinthe, and before that Inky Jack, and who was forever in his heart Agassou, his sister, whom he had known as Watutu, who had been called Mary on her first plantation in the Carolinas, and Daisy when she had become a house slave, and Suki when she was sold to the Levere family down the river in New Orleans, felt the cold bayonet slide between her ribs and started to scream and weep uncontrollably. Her twin daughters woke and began to howl. They were cream and coffee-colored, her new babies. Not like the black children she had borne when she was on the plantation, and little more than a girl herself, children she had not seen since they were 15 and 10 years old. The middle girl had been dead for a year when she was sold away from them. Suki had been whipped many times since she had come ashore. Once salt had been rubbed into the wounds. On another occasion she had been whipped so hard and for so long that she could not sit or allow anything to touch her back for several days. She had been raped several times when younger, by black men who had been ordered to share her wooden pallet, and by white men. She had been chained. She had not wept then, though. Since her brother had been taken from her, she had only wept once. It was in North Carolina, when she had seen the food for the slave children and the dogs poured into the same trough, and she had seen her little children scrabbling with the dogs for the scraps. She saw that happen one day, and she'd seen it before, every day, on that plantation, and she would see it again many times before she left. She saw it that one day, and it broke her heart. She had been beautiful for a while, and the years of pain had taken their toll, and she was no longer beautiful. Her face was lined, and there was too much pain in those brown eyes. 11 years earlier, when she was 25, her right arm had withered. None of the white folk had known what to make of it. The flesh seemed to melt from the bones, and now her right arm hung by her side, little more than a skeletal arm covered in skin, and almost immobile. After this, she had become a house slave. The Casterton family, who had owned the plantation, were impressed by her cooking and house skills. But Mrs. Casterton found the withered arm unsettling, and so she was sold to the Levert family, who were out for a year from Louisiana. Monsieur Levert was a fat, cheerful man who was in need of a cook and a maid of all work, and who was not in the slightest repulsed by the slave Daisy's withered arm. When a year later they returned to Louisiana, slave Suki went with them. In New Orleans, the women came to her, and the men also, to buy cures and love charms and little fetishes. Black folks, yes, of course, but white folks too. The Levert family turned a blind eye to it. Perhaps they enjoyed the prestige of having a slave who was feared and respected. They would not, however, sell her freedom. Suki went into the bayou late at night, and she danced the kalinda and the bambula, like the dancers of Saint-Domingue and the dancers of her native land. The dancers in the bayou had a black snake as their voodoo. Even so, the gods of her homeland and of the other African nations did not possess her people as they had possessed her brother and the folk of Saint-Domingue. She would still invoke them and call their names to beg them for favors. She listened when the white folk spoke of the revolt in Saint-Domingo, as they called it, and how it was doomed to fail. Think of it, a cannibal land! And then she observed that they no longer spoke of it. Soon it seemed to her that they pretended that there never had been a place called Saint-Domingo. And as for Haiti, the word was never mentioned. It was as if the whole American nation had decided that they could, by an effort of belief, command a good-sized Caribbean island to no longer exist, merely by willing it so. A generation of Levert children grew up under Suki's watchful eye. The youngest, unable to say Suki as a child, had called her Mama Zuzu, and the name had stuck. Now the year was 1821, and Suki was in her mid-50s. She looked much older. She knew more of the secrets than old Sanite Dede, who sold candies in front of the Cabildo, more than Marie Salope, who called herself the Voodoo Queen. Both were free women of color, while Mama Zuzu was a slave, and would die a slave, or so her master had said. The young woman who came to her to find what had happened to her husband styled herself the Widow Paris. She was high-breasted and young and proud. She had African blood in her, and European blood, and Indian blood. Her skin was reddish, her hair was a gleaming black, Her eyes were black and haughty. Her husband, Jacques Paris, was perhaps dead. He was three-quarters white, as these things were calculated, and the bastard of a once proud family, one of the many immigrants who had fled from St. Domingo, and as freeborn as his striking young wife.